Speaking at the memorial on Tuesday, President Obama said the Islamic faith is not to blame for Nidal Malik Hassan's shooting spree at Fort Hood.
No faith justifies these murderous and craven acts. No just and loving God looks upon them with favor. For what he has done, we know that the killer will be met with justice in this world and the next.
But as more evidence emerges, it seems the military could have identified Hassan as a risk last year. Or could they? You want to name someone to blame. You need a name. Hassan's lawyer says he can't possibly get a fair trial. Will the military get a fair shake? Or is Congress just looking for someone to blame? Finding fault where it lies on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 12th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Celeste. So coming up this hour, we've got the disturbing background of Major Hassan coming into focus. A lot of questions there. Your money or your rights? Budget crunches in Georgia are hurting indigent defendants. And cash for clunky schools? The White House asks states, who wants to be a billionaire?
But first, Scott Shane joins us. He's the national security reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Scott, there seems to be increasing evidence that somebody dropped the ball when it came to identifying some potentially disturbing behavior from the suspected Fort Hood shooter, Major Nidal Malik Hassan. Who was at fault here?
Well, there are two places that I think investigators are going to be looking at. One is the fact that Major Hassan had sent some emails to a radical cleric in Yemen in late 2008. And those emails were captured and analyzed, and the decision was made that they didn't represent any threat. So there may be some second-guessing on that point. And the other is his colleagues at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, some of whom thought that he showed alarming views of the war and alarming views of whether Muslims should participate in the war, and some even raised questions about his demeanor and perhaps his mental stability.
Is there a failure on the part of these agencies to communicate properly with each other?
Well, I think right now there's a lot of finger-pointing and a lot of leaping to conclusions. It's probably going to take a much more measured assessment to decide whether there was really fault somewhere or whether, in fact, this was not necessarily preventable.
Okay, Scott Shane, stay with us. We're going to talk more about that in just a few minutes. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
President Obama heads to Asia today, his first trip to the region since he arrived at the White House. First stop, Japan. Earlier, we spoke with Martin Fackler, correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, in Tokyo.
Obama is very well regarded here. In fact, he's even a bit of an English teacher. People listen to his speeches here to study English.
Plenty of chance to do that. Back home, the president rejected his national security team's proposals for a new strategy in Afghanistan. The president reportedly wants clear answers on how and when U.S. troops will hand over responsibilities to the Afghan government. It comes as the U.S. ambassador in Kabul is warning the president not to send thousands of more troops to the region. Carl Eikenberry, a former U.S. military commander in Afghanistan, says there are concerns about corruption within the Afghan government. United Nations official Richard Barrett agrees.
What goes on in Afghanistan remains 90% military and only 10% political, and I think that has to change.
Back home, as we've been hearing new details on accused Fort Hood gunman Major Nidal Malik Hassan, officials held meetings last year where they reportedly discussed whether Hassan was psychotic. More on this story in just a moment. Lou Dobbs told viewers he's resigning from CNN. Again.
The Dow posted its sixth straight gain. It finished up 44 points. The S&P rose 5.5 points to finish at a 13-month high. And the NASDAQ was up slightly as well. As we've been talking about, President Obama heads to Asia to talk about the economy and global warming and trade policies. But probably most importantly, he's going to be visiting with the superpower China. And we're asking you today, It's a very simple question. Do you think China will end up ruling the world? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Or do they already?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
More evidence is emerging about what officials knew about Nidal Malik Hassan before the shooting at Fort Hood and what they did not know. It seems U.S. intelligence officials knew that the suspected Fort Hood shooter was exchanging emails with a very radicalized cleric in Yemen.
I mean, this is a whole, what did they know, when did they know it, could it have possibly prevented the tragedy at Fort Hood last week?
And perhaps, why were they not talking to one another? Because the other thing that is being reported by our friend Scott Shane at the New York Times is that his colleagues, Hassan's colleagues at Walter Reed, knew that he was becoming increasingly unstable. So 8 years after 9/11, supposedly taught our law enforcement agencies that they need to share information. Why didn't these two groups communicate this information with each other? Scott Shane, National Security Reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Can you answer that? Have we not learned? Is this a question of the fact that this was nobody on either end was alarmed enough to call attention to put up the red flags? Or is this that we haven't learned the lessons of 9/11 and they're not communicating with one another?
Well, some of the folks that I talked to yesterday pointed out that, in fact, the system worked up to a point. They intercepted these emails so that they actually got hold of these emails. And instead of dumping them in a database somewhere, they actually did pass them on to a terrorism task force. They assigned someone to assess them. That person, again, didn't set it aside. He pulled Hassan's personnel file, records of his work at Walter Reed. But apparently one of the issues, and we don't know the contents of the emails exactly, but we've been told that they were largely questions, not comments, not expressions of extreme views, not certainly no hints that he had any violent acts in mind, but questions about Islamic interpretation. And that the cleric, whose name is Anwar al-Awlaki, wrote back a couple times, but in a very non-committal way, nothing inflammatory, not encouraging Hassan to take any act. So the judgment was made at the time, and I guess eventually when we see the emails and so on, we'll be able to make our own judgments, that it wasn't alarming. He also discovered that this seemed to be in line with research that Hassan was conducting. There seemed to be an innocent explanation for those communications.
Okay, and very quickly, what the questions among his colleagues at Walter Reed Medical Center was whether or not he was psychotic and fit for duty?
Well, I think there's actually quite a range of views among those colleagues. Some thought he was okay. Some were alarmed at his increasingly outspoken views against the war and against the participation of American Muslims in the war. But their concerns were never passed on to the guy who was examining the emails, and they never learned of the existence of the emails.
Right.
So it's true that those two halves of the puzzle were never put together.
Okay. Scott Shane, thanks. He's the New York Times national security correspondent. So at this point, the legal process begins. And to explain how this legal process works, what happens with Major Nidal Hassan now, we have Eugene Fidel. He teaches military law at Yale Law School. He's also president of the National Institute of Military Justice and joins us from Connecticut. Good morning, Eugene.
Hi, Celeste.
So take us through this process. Once the major gets out of the hospital, where does he go?
Into confinement. I have no question but that he'll be put in pretrial confinement, which is provided for under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or UCMJ. And just as a sort of first step in thinking about this, which jurisdiction would handle these charges?
You mean civilian or military?
Civilian or military, and state versus federal civilian. Personally, I think the center of gravity of this case is in the military setting. I don't have any doubt about that, and I think that it will be ultimately handled one way or another by the military justice system.
So, Eugene Fidel, I read a commentary from someone saying, look, this was a military officer who took a violent act against other military personnel on a military base. There's no question this will be a military trial. Is that accurate?
That's what I think.
Okay, so does the defendant have any say in where he gets tried?
No.
None at all?
None at all. I mean, his lawyers could try to make an argument that the case should be tried in the civilian federal courts.
But that holds no water.
I don't see any purpose in their doing that. I think it would be a wash as a practical matter. And the person can be tried by both the state and the military. There's no double jeopardy problem there. There's a slight legal issue as to whether the state would have jurisdiction here, depending on how the government happens to hold the piece of property on which...
Whether it's federal land.
It's exclusive federal land.
The other question I had is that his lawyer appears to already be establishing as much as he can that Major Hassan is going to have a very tough time getting a fair trial. Is this his argument to try and move the venue of this trial?
Personally, I think there will be a change of venue. I just, it's a very unusual set of facts. A lot of people have been killed and injured here. I'm not, making a judgment about ultimate legal guilt, incidentally. People will form their own conclusions. But I think that it would be very wise of the military to simply move the venue. Yeah.
Now, what is the procedure if it were to go to civilian trial? I mean, under what circumstances? I know it's probably not going to happen, but this jurisdictional question is kind of interesting. I mean, if, for example, one or more of the people killed were civilians, would there be any option to go to a civilian court in addition? And does the military have the ability to explicitly waive jurisdiction and put it into federal court on their own?
Yes. There's actually an agreement between the Department of Justice and the Defense Department. It goes back many years about how these things get resolved. And, there can be a conversation about it if you have a case that's sort of iffy as to which jurisdiction it should go to. The fact that there are civilians in the picture is sort of an atmospheric thing. It doesn't have particular legal significance. However, it is a federal crime to murder a member of the armed forces or other federal official when they're acting in the line of duty. So that would be a potential hook for taking the case into federal court. But again, I don't think that's going to happen.
So, Eugene, I have read several places that there seems to be no question that the death penalty is at least going to be considered here. How common is it for an officer of the rank of major to be in this kind of case facing the death penalty, possibly facing the death penalty?
I've never heard of it happening.
Wow.
Ever.
Correct.
Okay, Eugene Fidel teaches military law at Yale Law School. He's also president of the National Institute of Military Justice. Thanks for being with us. It's now 15 minutes past the hour. Let's take a news at the top headlines.
So President Obama wants more or different war options as he considers the next step in Afghanistan. A senior official says the president is refusing to accept any of the proposals presented by his national security team. Later, the president begins his first trip to Asia since arriving in the White House. Discussions will take place today on how to help the airline industry. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood is convening a top-level meeting on the topic. The industry has been rocked by crises in recent years, including 9/11 attacks, the SARS virus, and the current economic downturn.
CNN's Lou Dobbs told viewers he's quitting his nightly show to pursue new opportunities. Here he is giving his farewell on the network last night.
I'm the last of the original anchors here on CNN, and I'm proud to have had the privilege of helping to build the world's first news network.
It's the first world news network. Cable network. Dobbs began working at CNN when it began in 1980. An announcement on his replacement is expected today. And CNN reports this morning that the parents of the so-called balloon boy will admit to charges that it was all a hoax. The couple is expected to appear in court tomorrow morning. Last month, millions watched as a six-year-old was thought to be stranded in a weather balloon gliding across Colorado. And finally, police in Los Angeles are investigating conflicting accounts of an airport scuffle between former boxing champion Mike Tyson and a photographer. That's a look at some of the stories that were watching this morning. Coming out, bailed out banks are stepping up their PR campaigns, trying to get some money out to charitable funds, more money out to charitable funds, and the right charitable funds. We'll discuss whether or not that's working to get them into the public's good graces in just a few minutes.
And we'll talk to Todd Zwillick, who's not replacing Lou Dobbs. There's no truth to that story.
Really?
Todd Zwillick is not the replacement for Lou Dobbs.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Oh, yeah. Takeout. We're looking at some stories this week that we want you to stay on top of. And we begin on Capitol Hill. And I'm watching Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent, that the ball now is in the Senate's court. The health care bill, which was passed over the weekend with the so-called Stupak Amendment, named for that Michigan congressman, all about restricting federal funds for abortion. That amendment is turning out to be something of a test of the power of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. What's going on, Todd?
Well, it is. You know, Reid has dual responsibilities. Of course, he's the Senate Majority Leader, like you said, and his responsibility is to craft this health care bill so that it passes, first of all, and so that it passes to the political advantage of his Democrats. That's his responsibility. The other part of his responsibility is to get reelected back in Nevada, because he's up in 2010, and Harry Reid is not very popular at home right now, so these might be competing things for him. John, pro-choice groups are absolutely furious over the Stupak Amendment. Pro-life groups are saying they will be furious if it doesn't stay in. This is a classic sort of political, you know, immovable force and immovable object. Barack Obama tried really hard to take this vociferous fight over abortion off the table. Remember when he went to Notre Dame and sort of said, everybody just settle down, let's not get too heated, we can handle this like adults? That's not what's happening here. This is starting to heat up, and it's going to be tough for Reid when the Senate comes back.
Now, over in the House, you've got 40 votes or so that were the Blue Dog Democrats who voted against the bill on issues that are in the health care bill itself. But you've also got 40 progressive liberal Democrats who will vote against this bill with the Stupak Amendment. What's the math over in the Senate? Is it 10 to 10, 20 to 20, 5 to 5?
It was actually 64 Dems who voted for the Stupak Amendment over in the House. In the Senate, it's less clear, but there are more and more moderate pro-life Democrats coming out saying that they want the Stupak language in, and then, of course, the liberals saying it has to be out. And now the problem for Reid is, like we said, he has to craft a bill. And then you have to look at Reid's re-election prospects back home. He's an interesting case. His voter rating from the National Right to Life Committee, one of the leading pro-life organizations, is around 30%. It's fallen a bit. His rating from NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League, on the pro-choice side, right around 30%. So what's Harry Reid going to do? He's done a great job of keeping himself relatively neutral on this, but he has to balance a Democrat's interests, the president's interests, and his own interests, and it is totally unclear how he's going to do it.
Cagey up till now, but he's got to get off the fence. Todd Zwillick, a Takeaway Washington correspondent, talking about Harry Reid, abortion, and the health care bill in the Senate.
Now to the business takeout, a little advice from Saturday Night Live to the banks on Wall Street.
Just a tip, if you're trying to convince people that you care about things other than money, may I suggest removing the words gold and sack from your name? Really?
Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. A little bit of humor going on there. That's their take on an issue. But that's an issue that you guys covered in the paper. You're analyzing the tax returns of the Goldman Sachs Foundation to see what they're doing to give back to the community. And what did you find?
So in these very in-depth filings, they're about the size of a phone book. Wow. You can see not only who Goldman's giving money to, but also what they're trading in, how they're investing a lot of their foundation in hedge funds. But among the recipients of money, you see they gave $3.2 million last year to Johns Hopkins and $2.3 million last year to Duke. And I'm sitting here kind of scratching my head saying, gee, I don't know if giving to these kind of elite universities is going to help Goldman's reputation. And that's the central problem here. I don't know if you caught this, but Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman, recently told the Times of London that Goldman was, quote, doing God's work.
Yes.
Yes.
But is it possible that it is just charitably motivated and it's not all about PR?
Oh, the foundation?
Yeah, the giving of money.
Well, see, here's the problem, though. When he says we're doing God's work, he's talking about the work they do every day.
Right.
He says we help companies to grow by helping them to raise capital. And the problem is that most people out there don't think doing God's work entitles you to such high bonuses. You know, Goldman's probably going to pay out more than $10 billion in bonuses. So it's got people saying, why don't you give more to charity?
Now they've said they're going to possibly double the size of their charitable giving from $200 million to $400 million. But, you know, the question is here, is there anything Goldman's going to do to be able to make themselves sound like the benefactors of the people?
Probably not. And the other issue is that doubling the size of this foundation, when you look at the tax returns, you don't see them giving a lot of money from the foundation to causes that average people out there care about. Again, you know, $3.2 million to Johns Hopkins doesn't resonate. When I look at the giving of other banks like Citigroup and Bank of America, what strikes me is that they're giving tons and tons of grants to places, to little groups across the whole
local
country
community
and Citigroup
efforts
across the world. And so they're very visible out there, you know, giving 10,000
right
here, 10,000 there. And I think that that really lets people know that they care in some form, and that may be the direction Goldman needs to go in for the first time.
Okay, Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks for being with us.
Well, for our last takeout, you folks out there cared about what we asked on the program earlier this week. We asked if we were doing enough in this country for the men and women who serve in the armed forces.
No, we're not giving our veterans enough. It's not fair. It's not fair across the board. Something's got to be done, and to look at one individual thing and say, is this fair, is itself unfair.
That was Eric from Ann Arbor. Here's another listener who called in from Belmont, New York.
I try when I'm in an airport. You know, you tend to see a lot of troops there in uniform. And I try to thank them for their service and talk to them about what it's like and just connect with them and let them know that whatever I may think about the war, I do appreciate their service and shake their hand or give them a hug.
Thomas, a veteran of the Navy, emailed us. In a word, no. No, for example, all veterans discharged under honorable conditions are entitled to receive medical benefits. It's great, except that Congress, in its wisdom, does not fund those medical benefits for all eligible veterans. Thanks for asking, though.
And Brooke emails us, the best we can do for our veterans is not to create any more. Bring them home. We always welcome your takes on everything.
8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a gravy train becomes a contest. Schools competing to get federal aid. More about that in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama is rejecting, reportedly, the four options presented by his national security team for Afghanistan. Edmund McWilliams, a former senior U.S. diplomat in Afghanistan, says the president has one important thing on his mind.
The president is saying we need to have an end game strategy here, how we basically will transfer responsibility to Afghan forces.
Our partner, the New York Times, says the president is focusing on how to train the maximum number of Afghan security forces. That strategy would appear to be in line with the view of the U.S. ambassador in Kabul, who's warning the White House against any further military buildup of American forces. Carl Eikenberry, a former commander in Afghanistan, says more troops would be unwise because of Afghan government corruption.
President Obama leaves today for a week-long trip to Asia. First stop is Japan, followed by a stay in Singapore, and then a three-day visit to China. While in China, Human Rights Watch wants the president to pressure the Chinese government into closing secret jails. We're going to have more on that story in just a moment. Back at home, CNN anchor Lou Dobbs had this surprise announcement on his show last night.
This will be my last broadcast here on CNN, where I've worked for most of the past 30 years and where I have many friends and colleagues whom I admire deeply and respect greatly.
This is actually the second time that the longtime anchor has resigned live on air. And 19-year-old Taylor Swift is the youngest artist ever to win the Entertainer of the Year Award at the Country Music Awards last night. A week ago, we talked to her about her rise to the top of the charts.
Everything starts from a dream that you have when you're a little kid in your bedroom daydreaming. That's how everything starts. Whether you stick with it or whether you fall in love with something else, that's all for life to decide, but I would encourage those 8-year-old daydreams because that's a beautiful thing.
Swift also took home Female Vocalist of the Year and Album of the Year. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Race you to the top of the morning. Come sit on.
Yes, Race to the Top is not something that President Obama pulled from the Broadway musical The Secret Garden, but it is an educational program that wagers $4 billion and offers it to states if they can come up with programs that are entrepreneurial enough, innovative enough to match the kind of radical solutions that President Barack Obama called for in educational reform during the campaign. And it's run by Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education. Joining us to talk about this methodology and what the contest actually entails is Beth Fertig, education reporter for member station WNYC in New York, author of the new book, Why Can't You Teach Me to Read? Three students and a mayor put our schools to the the test. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
And Jeannie Allen is president of the Center for Education Reform. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Jeannie, good morning.
Good morning.
So Beth, how does this contest work? And as an educational reform mechanism, what do you make of it?
Well, what it's doing is it's encouraging key reforms that are favored by the Obama administration so that the states will be rewarded with hundreds of millions of dollars if they're big states like New York or California, maybe 20, 40 million for smaller states if they plan to enact certain reforms. And those are by order of this is how the Obama administration sums them up. They have to be improving their standards and assessments to get students ready for college.
So measurements. So it's
right.
Kind of the No Child Left Behind sort of idea.
Effective educators. They want effective teachers and ways of measuring that. They want data systems to support student achievement. And they want turnarounds of low-performing schools. And then what they do is they have a point system. When the state applies, they can get a maximum of 500 points. And when you look at the eligibility guidelines and where the points are, you really see what their priorities are. For example, the whole section on how to come up with great teachers and leaders is worth 138 points, which is the biggest chunk of those 500 points. And specifically, they would give 58 points to improving teacher effectiveness based on performance, which is where you get into
How do you determine student achievement?
Then they also have a big chunk for turning around failing schools. That would get 40 points. And then another big chunk is for charter schools. That gets 40 points. So you can see what their priorities are and the policies that they're favoring in this approach.
Speaking of favoring, are certain states, in terms of the way they fund education or the way they manage education, favored in this contest, more likely to win than others?
Well, the Obama administration officially says that everyone's got a chance to apply. But when you look at the landscape out there, for example, last week, President Obama went to Wisconsin to praise that state for getting rid of what's called a data firewall, a law that limits the use of student achievement in measuring teacher effectiveness. California also got rid of such a law, and the Obama administration praised them. But New York continues to have a law banning the use of student test scores in determining teacher tenure. So right away, that seems to disqualify New York, although there's a lot of arguments here about that.
Well, Jeannie Allen, so $4 billion is put on the table, encourages states to come up with radical new programs. The money is awarded, the programs succeed and are generalized throughout the country. What's wrong with a program like that?
Oh, don't get me wrong. These are the things that make education reformers swoon, John. Charter schools, providing more autonomy, evaluating teachers, turning around and hopefully closing failing schools. This is the menu. This is the portfolio that we think turn around schools. The problem is, and early indications from states suggest, that there's a lot of gaming going on. That in the race to the top, some of our states have not done the training they need to do and don't plan to, but they plan and they've already put tons of money to writing really beautiful applications. And I've been in D.C. through now four administrations watching education. Sort of like baking a cake, and I've seen way too many times where great intention programs like this, where the federal government and the president is really playing out what is his natural role, and Beth summarized the program great. These are reforms that really can work for kids. But that, unfortunately, we are boosting everyone's hopes over a program to encourage states to do things that they already can do now, and that many of them, if you look at the changes in the new regulations and you look at some of their plans, intend to do, frankly, with a little less gusto than you'd expect in a race. So, when you look, for example, at the stuff having to do with teachers, we all know that teachers next to families are the best indicator of whether a child is going to succeed or fail.
Okay.
Jeannie, I have to ask you, we just talked yesterday with some people from Michigan where they're intending to cut the educational budget by even more. We spoke to a teacher who said she may get a class size of 30 students, and they said the Detroit public schools are saying, bring it on, what does it matter at this point? Our problems are so high. It seems to me like this kind of program, this race to the top contest, couldn't be further down on the priority list for some of these school systems, which are in terrible crisis right now.
Well, that's right. And when you look at Celeste, what they're doing in terms of cutting those funds, funds. Instead of looking at great, successful schools and building them up, they're worrying about spending money on schools that have long failed our kids, and that's one of the big issues. Is Michigan going to apply and get money and put it into the same systems where people are escaping school systems, or are they going to put it against reforms that will make a difference in less than a generation for kids?
Okay, Jeannie Allen is president of the Center for Education Reform, describing the tension there between innovation and simply operating. Beth Fertig, give us a last word here.
Well, I would just say that part of the application also says that the states have to get buy-in from their local districts. And so what you're pointing out in Michigan, if the school districts are starving and they don't want all the money taken away from them and put into charter schools, for example, you're going to have to get the buy-in of these local districts, and that's going to be pretty difficult, too.
And, of course, there's a whole question of what about the schools that lose? It's kind of the sad part of the story. Beth Fertig, education reporter for member station WNYC in New York City, author of the book Why Can't You Teach Me to Read? It's the race to the top, the Obama administration's new program to incentivize education reform with a contest with cash prizes. Coming up in this week's tech segment, we're going to look at the advances being made in prosthetic limb development and the effect it's having on troops returning from war. That story in just a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. So it may or may not come up on President Obama's Asia trip, but a new report alleges that China is operating a large system of black jails where citizens are detained for a petition for redress from the government. When they go into Beijing and try to get petition the government for something,
any of
the major cities, they're thrown into jail. We have Keith Bradshaw here. So he's the New York Times Hong Kong bureau chief. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning.
What are the specific allegations in this report? And can you give us some ideas on who are these people that are being thrown into these secret jails?
There is a long tradition in China that if you feel the local, municipal, or even provincial officials are engaged in corruption or other abuses of power, you go to Beijing, you try to find somebody there who will listen to you and maybe can intervene. Now, the statistical evidence is that it's very rare for Beijing to intervene, but the municipal and provincial officials around the country don't appreciate it at all when somebody goes to Beijing and tries to air their dirty laundry as they view it. In fact, under the civil service promotion system nationwide in China, you get demerits if people are showing up in Beijing to complain about the job you're doing out in some town or province. So as a result, provincial and municipal governments from across China have been setting up these unofficial jails, which are outside of the judicial system, and they essentially grab people when they show up in Beijing, detain them, and hold them under often extremely bad conditions with sexual abuse, beatings, robbery, intimidation, denial of medical care, and denial of sleep for sometimes prolonged periods in these informal or unofficial jails, and then eventually send them back to their hometowns in the hope that this has intimidated them out of trying to lodge any kind of petition with the central government.
So how does this complicate the relations with the United States with President Obama on his way there? I mean, he's expected to talk about global warming and the economy for sure. Is he now going to have to address human rights?
Human rights is a tricky issue for U.S.-China relations because every time the United States brings it up, the Chinese say, this is an internal affair of China. This is not something on which we want to hear anything about from the United States. However, the National Security Council Director for East Asian Affairs did say in a phone briefing in Washington on Monday that President Obama would be bringing up human rights. He didn't specifically mention whether he'd be bringing up unofficial jails. But there are some, including Human Rights Watch, which released today's report, who say that it might be in the broader U.S. interest to have an attention to human rights. For example, if you really want product safety, they point out, in China, then maybe China needs an unfettered press that can cover examples of the adulteration of milk powder for babies, for example, which was a scandal last year, or the use of iron defects in toys and pharmaceuticals.
Or lead paint on kids' toys, I assume. Well, we'll see if it actually does come up when President Obama visits China for 3 days during his trip. That's Keith Bradshaw, a Hong Kong bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. He's talking about a new report from Human Rights Watch, which alleges that there are black jails, secret jails across China, which illegally detain people and keep them there and possibly abuse them while they're in these jails simply because they asked for help or petitioned a government official.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, a discussion of how some horrific wounds in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are encouraging the development of extraordinary new technology for prosthetic limbs. And we're going to talk with someone who's actually benefited from that technology. That in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Back to the drawing board now for President Obama's national security team regarding Afghanistan. An official says the president has decided not to accept any of the options that were on the table at a well-publicized meeting yesterday. Today, the president leaves for a week-long visit to the Far East, but first he makes a stop in Alaska, where he'll meet with service members at an Air Force base.
The governor of Virginia has declared a state of emergency as rain from the remnants of Tropical Storm Ida soaked the state, and North Carolina is bracing for another day of storms today. We talked to Nick Childs earlier this morning about the situation in Afghanistan. The U.S. ambassador to Kabul has written to the White House saying they should not send more troops there, and Nick Childs gave us more details about the secret memo from Ambassador Carl Eikenberry and his reasons for saying that we should not send additional American forces to Afghanistan.
I think fundamentally it's that he is very skeptical at the moment about the competence of the Karzai government, essentially. And, you know, he's grappling with the issue of how do you make it mend its ways in some ways. And I think he's worried that if there is an agreement to send more troops without, you know, proper conditions and proper details of how they'd reform themselves, that in the end you'll never get that sort of reform.
And is this connected to President Obama's need for an exit strategy, a date where we'd remove U.S. troops?
I think the fact that he's talking about, if you like, President Obama is talking about essentially leaning on Karzai himself a bit more, saying it's not an open-ended commitment, shows that that he feels the same concerns. And, you know, this is a big decision for him. We don't really know what his mind is on this at the moment. And clearly he has concerns about the political fallout both in Afghanistan and back in the United States. It's interesting, why did this memo leak now? Who is the leak aimed at? Maybe it's aimed at President Karzai to put some pressure on him. I think the worry is it will concern the allies that it's more mixed messages out of Washington on what President Obama will actually come up with in terms of his decision.
Nick Childs is the defense and security correspondent for our partner, the BBC. We talked to him earlier this morning about the leaked memo from the U.S. ambassador in Kabul, who's arguing against sending more troops into Afghanistan.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him.
Robotic limbs will behave as if they're made of muscles and tendons and reflexes.
We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man.
Small electronic packages in muscles, attached to nerves, and even into the central brain.
We have the technology.
Our tech segment today is about technology transfer from the battlefield straight to the laboratory. And you hear the voice there in that $6 million man mashup of Professor Hugh Herr, who's a researcher at the MIT Media Lab Biomechatronics Research Group. He actually founded the group. It's all about taking technology from the digital age and applying it to the horrific war wounds, particularly amputations, that are involved in the battlefields in Afghanistan and Iraq. And there is some, and it's fair to say, cutting edge, sad to say, kind of freaky to say, cutting edge technology involved in the new prosthetics that are available for wounded veterans. Grant Elliott joins us. He's a researcher at the Biomechatronics Research Group. He's on the line at WGBH's studios up there in Boston. Grant, good morning.
Good morning.
And Will Borden is also with us. He's director of academic technology at the Shady Hill School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and lost his right leg in 1993 and is testing out some of the technology at the MIT lab. But Will Borden, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Grant Elliott, Hugh Hurry in that little mashup there mentions that limbs are becoming smarter. Artificial limbs are having in them a kind of intelligence that allows them to work with wounded individuals, with leg amputations particularly. What are you talking about there, Grant?
Well, just in the last decade, you've started to see these computer-controlled limbs appear on the marketplace. And these are really life-changing devices because they start to allow you to emulate natural human gaits rather than these rigid sorts of plastic behaviors that we've always seen in the past and that are traditionally associated with prosthetic devices. And in the last year or so, you're starting to actually see active devices that are effectively robots that you can put onto your body. So we're hoping that you can start building designs like that that really closely mimic the way the human body is constructed and controlled.
And Will Borden, what do you have on your body that is an application of some of what Grant Elliott is talking about?
Well, currently I just wear a flex foot module, which is what Dr. Hur would refer to as a passive prosthesis. But I have actually tried out these robotic prosthetics that they're talking about and experienced what that's like to walk in it.
And is it a thumbs up or a nice guy?
Oh, it's a huge thumbs
really,
up. It's just a totally revolutionary experience for me.
I've spent some time up at the Media Lab. But one of the things that is amazing to discover is that what makes a prosthetic realistic is not how it looks, but how it moves, right?
I think that's absolutely right. And in fact, for me, I think I always felt, I think in the beginning, a little bit uncomfortable with my prosthetic when it wasn't actually moving the way I wanted to, and I was more concerned about how it looked. But as I've tried more prosthetics that move in a more natural way, you actually become excited about the movement part of it and the mechanics. You almost want to show it off. These kind of the robotic look of the prosthetic becomes almost a good thing instead of a bad thing.
So, Grant Elliott, no one is interested? Is that where we're headed here? No one is interested in a realistic-looking prosthetic, but they're absolutely demanding realistic-moving prosthetics, and that's what this technology is aimed at.
I think more and more, especially as we become a gadget-heavy society, people are much more willing to accept functionality over appearance. What Will is testifying to is actually something that we see all the time. It's kind of a divisive issue that tends to be age-dependent. Younger amputees want to hold up and revere their device. This is something exciting. They want to show it off. They go around in shorts. Whereas there are still other populations that would prefer something that can be made a little bit more discreet. So you still have to accommodate that. But more and more people are starting to lean towards a focus on devices that can do everything that they wanted to do before they lost their limb.
And it really benefits a generation that's not exclusively of the Iraq-Afghanistan age. Our own Femi Oke was speaking with veterans from the Vietnam era. And listen to what this veteran, John Lucen, said.
I was wounded in Vietnam in 1967 and resulting in a high amputation of my left leg. And I got involved in prosthetics basically just because I am an amputee. We're providing the generation that I was in 67, 68, 69 with new devices that are even better and better. We're fitting them with a lot of new different types of technology.
Grant, I have two questions for you. First, how much has the technology changed from the Vietnam era?
Oh, leaps and bounds. It's the nature of this sort of work that huge progress is made associated with each great war. And certainly the Vietnam War kick-started the nascent field, and you started to see this material science revolution that led to springy legs and the like that really started to make it possible to emulate human gait. And of course, recent issues in Afghanistan and Iraq have certainly led to more and more funding for this field.
And created the urgency.
Well,
let's just describe the frontiers of research, though. You've got a great work on the foot. You're working on the ankle and knee. But the real holy grail is a smart shoulder, right?
Oh, absolutely. Upper limb technology is a very different beast than the lower limbs. If for no other reason, the control is totally different. In the lower limbs, what you're looking at is kind of these physics-based architectures to ensure walking gaits, running gaits, all of these very rhythmic patterns. In the upper limbs, everything is all about instantaneous control. I want to consciously
right.
do something.
Right. And feedback.
So the problems are extremely different.
And you need a greater access, a higher bandwidth access to the brain itself to make progress on the upper limbs, right?
Sure.
All right. Well, it's an exciting field of science. Will Borden, do they have any jetpacks for you there at the MIT Media Lab?
No, not yet.
any dream that you have when you go to the biomechatronics lab?
Well, it was funny. I was able to take my students there, a group of seventh graders, and for them to be able to see this, you know, these incredible inventions in person and the practical application of mathematics and science, like through their eyes, I became kind of even more excited about it.
Oh, and that is amazing. Will Borden is director of academic technology at the Shady Hill School in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's a single amputee. And Grant Elliott is a researcher at the MIT Media Lab Biomechatronics Research Group, working on prosthetics for wounded war veterans. Very high-tech prosthetics. Thanks so much to both of you. You can read a blog entry by our own Femi Okeh about her visit to a prosthetics lab at the Veterans Administration Medical Center here in New York, and watch a video of a technician at work making legs. That's at thetakeaway.org.
And while you're there, respond to our question today. President Obama is headed off to Asia. He's going to meet with officials in China for 3 days. And from its economic growth to its geopolitical status, not to mention a huge holder of American debt, China is definitely on the rise. And we're asking you, do you think China is poised to rule the world? Dana from Massachusetts called in to say, that sounds like a comic book question. I'm no fan of the Chinese government, but we're all kind of interdependent. There will always be power struggles. But no, I don't think any one nation will rule the world.
I'm John Hockenberry. Comic book questions. That's right. That's right.
That's what we're all about here. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Speaking truth to China.
Obviously, China is rising, and it's not going away. They're neither our enemy nor our friend. They're competitors.
As a candidate, Barack Obama said that about that other superpower, China, back in 2007. Today, he leaves for his first Asia trip as president. Who's rising now?
Obviously, China is rising. Obviously, China is rising.
Not going away.
Our enemy, our friend. Our enemy, our friend. It's not going away.
The converging fortunes of the U.S. and China, trying to remain friendly competitors. We're not going away.
Obviously.
On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everybody. Thursday, November 12th. I'm John Hockenberry. Good morning.
I'm Celeste Headlee. Good morning. Coming up, no love for Dixie at Ole Miss. The university cannot play their fight song anymore. And the state of Georgia says it's not a moral issue, it's about money. Georgia may not be able to afford the death penalty anymore. Also, Woody Harrelson talks about his new film and why an officer can't hug a person when they've told them that a loved one has died.
But first, joining us now is Kenneth Lieberthal, director of the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution down in Washington, D.C. Kenneth, good morning.
Good morning.
The President Obama leaves for Asia today, we noted there at the top of the hour. His final destination is China, but he'll be all over the region before that. I'm wondering, is there anything for Obama to talk about with Japan, Korea, and Singapore and the other Asian tigers other than what to do about the rising China in their region?
Absolutely. We have specific issues for each stop. For example, in Japan, there's a new Japanese government, a new party in power for the first time in many, many years. They've raised a lot of issues about the U.S.-Japan alliance and other related matters. He's going to want to go over all of that with them. But he has a fundamental message that he's trying to convey everywhere in Asia. And that fundamental message is not that China is rising, but that the U.S. is back. We're going to engage in the region. We're there for the long term. We're there to discuss regional issues as well as bilateral issues. We're there to listen as well as to talk. He wants to convey his image of where the U.S. is headed, why Asia is important. He
right.
wants to hear what others have to say and communicate that we take this region very seriously.
That's very complete. All right. We'll talk about the details of the Asian trip in bilateral terms in just a moment with Kenneth Lieberthal from the Brookings Institution. Sounds like China isn't ruling the world, at least at this moment. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
New jobless numbers have just come in. The Labor Department says in its weekly report that initial job claims for jobless benefits fell by 12,000 to 502,000 in the week ending November 7th.
That's starting to feel like a trend.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the lowest level, actually, since January. And we've learned more details this morning about the Fort Hood story. Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting that when the alleged gunman, Major Nidal Malik Hassan, worked at the Walter Reed Medical Center, some of his colleagues had serious doubts about him. Earlier, we spoke to Times reporter Scott Shane.
Some thought he was okay. Some were alarmed at his increasingly outspoken views against the war and against the participation of American Muslims in the war.
The Times also reports these doubts about Hassan were never passed to the officials examining the emails that the major was exchanging with a radical cleric in the Mideast. And the U.S. ambassador in Kabul agrees with President Obama. President Obama has sent his security team back to the drawing board. He's rejected, reportedly, all their proposals for Afghanistan strategy. And the U.S. ambassador, Carl Eikenberry, a former top military commander in Afghanistan, has warned the White House not to send more troops there. He says the Afghan government is ineffective.
9-day trip to Asia begins for the president today, as we noted. The first stop is Tokyo. In China, there may be pressure on the president to raise the issue of secret jails there. A Human Rights Watch report accuses China of kidnapping and imprisoning citizens who complain to the authorities. Sixth straight gain for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It was up 44 points yesterday. The S&P rose 5.5 points to finish at a 13-month high. The NASDAQ up slightly as well. The futures trading suggests a negative opening or a flat opening when Wall Street gets underway in about a half hour from now. So as the president heads to Asia, what do you think? Is China going to rule the world? Does it already? Is that a silly question? Any answer is acceptable. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. But it's certainly on the agenda in the other hemisphere. Does China rule the world?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. So the president departs this hemisphere tonight.
Absolutely.
Heads off for an 8-day trip to Asia. He's going to visit Seoul, Singapore. He'll spend 3 days in China. And the conventional wisdom is, of course, China is the whole ball of wax there.
Right.
The huge issues all involve China. And the big issues on this trip are going to be global warming, the economy, nuclear proliferation, particularly in North Korea. But the first destination is Tokyo, and it'll be a chance for Barack Obama to spend some time with the new Japanese Prime Minister Hatoyama, who has recently called for a more, quote, equal relationship with the United States. Rejoining us is Kenneth Lieberthal, director of the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. Ken, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Martin Fackler, we contacted. He's the Tokyo bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. He's in Tokyo. He'll be there at the first destination of President Obama when he arrives there. Martin Fackler, good morning.
No, thank you. Good morning.
Martin, let's just begin with you. Ken Lieberthal suggested that there are very important bilateral issues that Barack Obama will need to address with each of his counterparts in Seoul, South Korea, and in Singapore. What are the issues in Tokyo?
Well, I think the main issue is the American bases in Okinawa. The new government in Japan has come into office promising to alleviate the burden for Okinawans. And I think that there's a lot of miscommunication now, and people aren't seeing eye to eye on exactly how they're going to do that. But I think that Washington and Tokyo need to work out some sort of a plan for how to address Japan's concerns.
Now, you could hear some of that confusion or lack of communication or speaking at odds in the words of Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, and he was speaking last month talking about the Futenma Air Base, which is on the island of Okinawa, which seems to be the major issue here.
Without the Futenma facility, there will be no relocation to Guam. And without relocation to Guam, there will be no consolidation of forces and return of land in Okinawa.
It sounds like he's ruling out any change in the status quo, Martin Fackler.
Yeah, that was the tone. The tone from Washington so far is they want to go with the original deal, which is to relocate that air station at Futenma to another place in Okinawa. The problem is the Okinawans are furious. They want the base off their island, and Tokyo is caught in the middle. They want to appease their partner in Washington, but at the same time, they've also got public opinion at home, particularly in Okinawa, which voted for the party of Prime Minister Hatoyama during the most recent election.
Kenneth Lieberthal, let's talk a little bit about the economic relationship between the U.S. and Japan. It seems to me that Barack Obama would have some clout with China if he could get Japan's economy restarted, and the combined U.S. and Japanese economic might would seem to be a formidable competitor to what's going on in China. Is that what needs to happen? Does the Japanese economy need to come alive for the economic relationship to have more meaning?
No, I don't think so. The Japanese economy right now is, like the U.S. economy, increasingly integrated with the Chinese economy. a lot of Japan's exports to the United States, produce the major part of the export in Japan, but then send it to China for a final assembly and some additional work, and then to the U.S. So to pose these economies as if they were each a kind of self-contained block and you move them around on a chessboard, I think misses what's really been going on. The Chinese have become the point of final assembly for parts and components from all over Asia and largely for export to Europe and the United States. So this is simply a complex set of interrelationships. It's not a matter of if we jumpstart Japan, we can jumpstart ourselves, then we can block China's rise or something like that. It simply doesn't set up that way at all in the real world.
Martin Fackler, is it possible, though, that Obama has an argument if Japan's economy improves, that represents jobs for Americans in Japanese-owned factories back in the United States?
Well, there's certainly an argument for improving the economy just because for the last 20 years, Japan has been a bit of a dead weight on the world economy. It would be nice to have another engine to global growth besides the United States. And of course, China has been coming up as well. But Japan is still the world's second largest economy, and it really has been stuck in neutral for about two decades now. So it would be nice to kind of get some life back to the Japanese economy and get some growth. And I think there's definitely an argument to be had there.
What do people say on the streets in Japan? Do they believe that China is inevitably going to, you know, sort of rule the world in terms of their region and their hemisphere? And does the Barack Obama charisma, you know, hold much weight on the streets of Tokyo?
Let me ask the second one first. I believe Obama is very well regarded here. In fact, he's even a bit of an English teacher. People listen to his speeches here to study English, so he's a very popular figure here.
Wow.
With the first question, there's a lot of concern about China, but there's also a lot of hope about China. It's a complex issue here because the Japanese economy is very much wedded to the Chinese economy now. And so there's concern about China's military presence. There were some incidents a few years ago where a Chinese submarine went through Japanese waters, and Chinese ships drilling platforms have been looking for natural gas in waters also claimed by Japan. And so there is that sort of competitive side, but there's also the recognition that China is now Japan's largest trade partner. As Kenneth mentioned, many of the high-end products that are now built in Japan are components that are then assembled in China and then
right.
shipped to the world. So, Japan's future, I think if you talk to most folks here, really is tied to China as much as it is to the U.S. And so it really is a complex picture. I don't think it's a simple sort of fear or rivalry.
You know, we're talking a lot about trade and about the economy, Ken, and we spoke earlier with someone from Human Rights Watch saying that they hoped that the human rights issue came up on this trip, that the human rights issue seems to never come up on trips from U.S. Officials overseas to China. Is there any political will in Japan at all with them as their largest trading party to talk about human rights issues with China?
I think the statement, I don't know who made it, that human rights don't come up on trips by American officials to China is just simply flat wrong. It comes up on virtually every single trip an American official makes. Barack Obama certainly will raise it. The issue is whether we raise it in a very public fashion and seek to humiliate China's leaders while we're there on official visits, or whether we raise it persistently and more quietly and try to improve the situation over in China. But it is a constant theme on our agenda, so I just want to correct that record.
Well, you've got issues on the table and in the background. Ken Lieberthal, director of the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., thanks. And also thanks to Martin Fackler, Tokyo Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. And at 15 minutes past the hour, it's time now to look at some of the other stories we've been following.
The U.S. Labor Department said in its weekly report that initial claims for jobless benefits fell again by 12,000 to 502,000 this last week. That's the lowest level since January. President Obama is being advised by his ambassador in Afghanistan to not send additional troops to the country. Carl Eikenberry, who's also a former U.S. commander in Afghanistan, expressed doubts about the competence of the Afghan government.
Oh, I can't resist this. Celeste, go with me on this. A little story we just come across, you're going to love this. A bomb-sniffing dog belonging to Australian forces in Afghanistan has been found alive and well in the country 14 months after she went missing. That's right.
Months.
During a battle between Australian troops and the Taliban, the Black Labrador was found by an American soldier. The story has prompted a comment from the Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd.
Things like that, they may seem small, but in fact the symbolism is quite strong. And the symbolism of it is us out there doing a job.
Back to the bigger news. President Obama heads to the far... You know, a sigh of relief there, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
President Obama heads to the Far East today after a quick stop in Alaska. He'll travel to Japan, where he'll meet with the prime minister. Other stops include Singapore and China.
In more economic news, a report from RealtyTrack says the number of homeowners on the brink of losing their homes fell last month. Now, despite that, foreclosure filings are up nearly 20% from a year ago. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, the American Medical Association is weighing in on health reform. You think they'd be talking about their support for health reform? No, they're talking about their policy on don't ask, don't tell.
That's
We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
They're here. Now, they're here. In the studio.
They are. We've got Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our Takeaway Sports contributor here, and Louise Story talking about business from our partner, the New York Times.
Takeout.
And in Washington, for our quick takeout from Washington, we've got our very own Todd Dzwillik. Good morning, Todd.
Hi. Good morning, Celeste.
Okay, so the American Medical Association has always taken a stance on health care reform. They were famous for helping to defeat it in the 1930s and the 1950s. They almost prevented the passage of Medicare, and they've taken a position on health care reform, actually supporting health care reform now.
That's
and
right.
In an interesting take, they've come out to oppose the don't ask, don't tell policy about dealing with gays in the military. What does that have to do with the AMA?
Well, it has to do with really the health care of military service members. Basically, what the AMA has said is that don't ask, don't tell forces military personnel, if they're gay, to be secretive about their sexual orientation. Doctors don't want their patients to be secretive about anything that could affect their health. It might be their relationships, their sexual behavior, anything like that. So basically what the AMA has said is that don't ask, don't tell drives gay and lesbian people underground, and they may not be honest with their physicians, and that can negatively affect their health. Now, interestingly, the AMA also said that gay marriage bans can negatively affect the health of people outside the military. It's been known for a long time, at least accepted by the Institute of Medicine, that a lack of health insurance is bad for your health. You don't
right.
see your doctor as much. You don't have coverage for preventative services. The reasons for that are sort of easy to understand. Well, if gay marriage bans make it harder for spouses or domestic partners to get health care benefits, therefore harder to access health care services. Now, they did not call for overturning gay marriage bans, but they did say that they can negatively affect the health of gay and lesbian patients. So that's going to be now probably in the mix of the healthcare debate.
I assume that legislators would then argue, well, that just argues for us to get better health insurance coverage to everybody, and instead of dealing with marriage, let's just deal with who's insured and who isn't. But this is kind of feeding into the larger issue on where we stand in a lot of gay rights legislation in the Congress, right?
Well, that's right. And don't ask, don't tell is a huge marquee issue for the gay and lesbian political community. They haven't had any action on it yet, and they've been very frustrated about that. Now, a couple of weeks ago, the president did sign federal hate crimes legislation expansion to cover gay and lesbian
right.
people. That was a victory for gay and lesbian activists. But don't ask, don't tell has not been addressed. Now, Barney Frank, an openly gay member of Congress and a senior one, appeared in the press yesterday saying that don't ask, don't tell in the military is going to be repealed in military legislation next year. Now,
we'll
he's not a member
happens.
Of the leadership. He's going around saying that it's a done deal for next year. The White House is saying, we haven't decided that yet. It's a very touchy issue, as you can imagine.
I bet. Todd Dzwillik is our Takeaway Washington correspondent.
So, Todd, there's nothing secretive about the salaries for TARP-taking banks down there in Washington. Nothing secretive
right.
about that. And Louise Story, executive compensation pushback is going
yep.
on at AIG all
yep.
of a sudden. We own most of AIG,
yep.
but they're not happy with the executive compensation limits that the feds are putting on them.
That's right. You know, Ben Moshe, their CEO, he was appointed in August.
Robert Ben Moshe. He's the
yes,
CEO of AIG.
Let's be proper here.
A government employee, basically.
But, you know, he's not always so proper in his remarks because, you know, right after he was appointed in August, when he was referring to federal policymakers, he called them the, quote, crazies in Washington.
Oh, wow.
He's making friends.
So he always has melodramatic things to say. There have been reports that he's threatening to quit over these compensation rules.
Whom? Todd, you're a crazy in Washington, right?
Yeah.
Everyone in Washington's crazy.
Right. Well, thanks, Louise. We love having you here, by the way.
Right. But what he's doing now is really posturing over executive compensation. The compensation czar, Ken Feinberg, already ruled on the top 25 executives at AIG. He really reined in pay. Some of them, there are a couple of them there who are only making $125,000.
Oh, that's too bad.
I know. It sounds like a lot to some people, but for an executive, you know, it's a real cutback. And so Ben Moshe told employees yesterday he's committed to the company, but he's just fighting for their right to pay.
Quickly, does he have any clout?
Well, you know, it would be very disruptive for AIG if he left. And so it is actually, he really can posture some. He can throw his weight around because it would be hard for them to change CEO yet again a second time in a year.
Fighting for the high-paid executives at AIG, Robert Ben Moshe, a crusader down in
Washington. Social rights for Wall Street.
Speaking about high-paid people, let's talk about football players.
Yes.
With Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We've got Thursday Night Football starting tonight. The San Francisco 49ers and the Chicago Bears. Let's call it, Ibrahim. Who do you think is going to win?
Well, right now, okay, so the Bears are 4-4 and the 49ers are 3-5. The 49ers head coach is a guy named Michael Singletary, who was a legendary linebacker for the Chicago Bears.
84 Bears.
There you go. So, and the Chicago Bears have Lovie Smith, and Chicago had a love affair with him, but no longer do. They would rather have exactly. They would rather have Michael Singletary as their head coach. They would also rather have a defense that actually played and a quarterback that didn't throw interceptions. So I'm going to call it as the San Francisco 49ers having a bounce back and beating the Bears tonight.
Okay, we'll see if that happens. Here's another one. Let's talk about college football now. That is from Dixie with Love. That is the fight song played by the Ole Miss Band. And we have it's been an ongoing controversy there at the University of Mississippi over this song because of what they say at the end of it.
Yes, of course. From Dixie with Love. No, the South will rise again.
The South will rise again. And so the chancellor at the University of Mississippi says, forget it, stop playing the fight song.
Okay, so there's a lot of history, a lot of racial history that's a very racially charged incident. 1962, the first black student, James Meredith, there were riots and there were people killed on the campus in the 60s. Also in the 60s was the last time that Ole Miss won a national championship. You could argue that because of the stain that happened on that campus, they haven't bounced back from it. They've had Archie Manning play there. They've had Eli Manning play there. That's the only lore that's come back to that campus. And in the past 5 years, when they've started saying the South will rise again after the song, that's when they've done it mostly. The SEC has won 3 out of 5 of national championships. So really, the Ole Miss fans should be saying Ole Miss will rise again. Because right now, that's really what it sounds like. That's what they're saying. And also, 1935 is when they changed their nickname from the Flood to the Rebels. So to say that it's all about their history.
A lot of history speaking there.
This is not going to be a fight that ends soon.
Not at
Thanks,
all.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our Takeaway Sports contributor.
Good morning.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Well, there's always a debate over whether or not we should have the death penalty. In Georgia, the debate is over whether or not they can afford the death penalty. That story is coming up in just a few minutes. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. President Obama has just announced he'll hold a jobs summit at the White House in December. This as new unemployment numbers come in. The Labor Department says in its weekly report that initial claims for jobless benefits fell by 12,000 to 502,000 in the week that ended on November 7th. That's the lowest level since January. And a new report finds that the number of homeowners on the brink of losing their homes fell last month. That's the third straight month that foreclosures fell, but it's still up 19% from a year ago.
U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan has advised President Obama not to send thousands of new troops to the country. Carl Eikenberry has expressed concern about corruption in the Afghan government. Peter Galbraith, a former United Nations diplomat in Afghanistan, agrees.
The military mission cannot be accomplished if there's not a credible local partner. And the point he's making is that the corrupt government of President Hamid Karzai, now in office as a result of fraud, cannot be a reliable partner. And that's a view which I have been articulating and with which I agree.
President Obama is treading lightly, ordering revisions across the board on strategy in Afghanistan. He wants to see how and when U.S. troops would turn over responsibility to the Afghan government. President will be working on Afghanistan and other issues as he kicks off a week-long visit to the Far East later today. First stop, Japan, then Singapore, then a three-day visit to China. 19-year-old Taylor Swift is the youngest artist ever to win the Entertainer of the Year Award at the Country Music Awards last night. A week ago, we talked to the singing sensation about her rise to the top of the charts.
Everything starts from a dream that you have when you're a little kid in your bedroom daydreaming. That's how everything starts. Whether you stick with it or whether you fall in love with something else, that's all for life to decide. But I would encourage those 8-year-old daydreams because that's a beautiful thing.
Keep dreaming. Swift also took home Female Vocalist of the Year and Album of the Year. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
There's a very surprising case before the Georgia Supreme Court, and it might decide whether or not the state can afford the death penalty anymore. Jamie Weiss has been sitting in jail for 4 years waiting for a trial because the state can't afford to pay for adequate legal representation. So yesterday, Weiss appealed to have his charges dropped, or at least the death penalty part of them, taken off the board. We're going to talk now with Emily Green, a reporter covering the justice system for Georgia Public Broadcasting, and Robert McGlasson, an attorney who represented a previous death penalty defendant, Brian Nichols, in one of the most expensive cases in the state's history. And Robert has represented indigent defendants for 26 years. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Emily, can you explain exactly what this case before the Georgia Supreme Court is about? It appears that even the judge has said this is setting precedent on whether or not the state can afford the death penalty.
Well, Jamie Weiss was charged in 2006 with killing a woman in Georgia.
And during a burglary.
During a burglary, right. And he sat in jail for about 3.5 years. And during much of that time, there was wrangling over who would represent him because basically the state didn't have money to pay the lawyers who are representing him. And now Jamie Weiss's lawyers have gone before the Georgia Supreme Court to say this is a violation of the constitutional right to have a speedy trial. And they are asking that, at the very minimum, the death penalty portion of Jamie Weiss's trial be dismissed, and at most that all of the charges against Jamie Weiss be dismissed.
Okay, Robert, let's explain how large this scope is. I read that in recent weeks the State Office of the Capital Defender hasn't had enough lawyers to actually defend about 70 death penalty cases that are pending statewide. And you actually defended, as we said before, Brian Nichols, who was a defendant in a very expensive case. How widespread is this problem?
Well, Celeste, you've put your finger right on the problem here. The Weiss case is just a symptom of a much larger issue that's facing not only the Georgia indigent defense system, but similar systems all throughout the country. We all know we're having a major economic crisis in this country, and it's trickles down to state budgets and systems like those that are there to provide representation for indigent criminal defendants.
So, Emily, the state law requires that they have two state attorneys representing death penalty defendants. And part of the problem here is not only that they can't have two, but they can't have one. Is there a solution here that could actually affect whether in the outcomes of these cases? Or are they going to end up actually having to let some of these people go?
Well, it seems unlikely that they're going to be let people go. The Georgia Supreme Court is pretty conservative, and the Georgia General Assembly is very conservative. I think the ultimate solution would to be to greater fund Georgia's public defender system. It's very underfunded at this point, and that has, as you said, resulted in many people sitting in jail right now sort of waiting for lawyers. I think right now there are at least four people right now, and including one in a very high-profile case in the murder of boxing star Vernon Jones, who are sitting in jail and don't have two lawyers representing them. So I think the ultimate solution, though, will be to just fund Georgia's public defender system more.
Robert, they have actually been cutting funding to the public defender system over the past few years. At the same time, they're calling for more funding, but they're cutting it. I don't think anyone is thinking that Georgia is not going to have the death penalty anymore, right?
Well, I it's hard to say, but I would agree with Emily that the solution is to provide adequate funding. The problem is we have a very staunchly Republican legislature here who's actually, as you mentioned, gone the other way and decreased the funding over the years instead of increased it, and it's created this crisis. And until that changes, you have defendants like Weiss and hundreds of others throughout the state in which we're just embedding constitutional violations that, if they ever get to trial, will require reversal on appeal. So this is a problem that's just going to snowball and get bigger and bigger as time goes on. And I don't foresee the current legislature dealing with the root of the problem, which is providing adequate funding. In the meantime, the answer is people like Jamie Weiss are going to have their constitutional rights protected. And in his case, I suggest that the only way that can be done is to take the death penalty off the table, and including in these other cases that are facing similar problems.
You know, Jamie, let's talk about Jamie Weiss real briefly, because he is sitting there in pretrial mode. He has absolutely no legal counsel at all while he's sitting in incarceration. And from what I understand, he also has been exhibiting some serious mental illness signs, and he's not being treated.
He's tried to commit suicide three times. One time he was found hanging in his cell, and he tried to fight the guards off while they were cutting him down. He slit his wrist twice. He's been on major medications. Those medications have been adjusted many times, and the state doctors who've examined him, these aren't private defense appointed doctors. These are doctors for the state mental health system, have all found him to be severely mentally ill, psychotic, et cetera,
like
throughout
Gitmo.
The time he's been incarcerated.
It sounds like Gitmo.
Yeah, it's a terrible situation. This is in Pike County, about 100 miles south of Atlanta, and you know the jail system there itself is overburdened with lack of funding and so forth. And so he's getting minimum kinds of attention and so forth, all the while not being represented by a lawyer.
Right,
now keep
no
in mind
that
the prosecution, the police, their investigators, they're all getting paid. They're all working on the case for 3.5 years. They're
right.
Saying they're ready for trial, of course.
Okay, Robert McGlasson is a local attorney in Atlanta, Georgia, who's represented indigent defendants for 26 years. He's now in private practice. Emily Green is a reporter covering the justice system for Georgia Public Broadcasting. This story about Georgia is part of our continuing series this week about the impact of state budget cuts on daily life in the United States. These cuts that are caused by the recent economic turndown, which are the kind that we really feel in our homes
every day.
The
Constitution gives rights, but the tax code takes them away.
It's stark. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We're expecting the president to announce momentarily a job summit at the White House next month. The unemployment rate, of course, is 10.2%, and the numbers released today suggest things might be improving. New claims for unemployment down by 12,000. When the numbers confuse us, we often like to talk to Kelly Evans, Wall Street Journal reporter, who's on the line with us. We haven't talked with her in a while. Kelly, good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
Yeah, so I want to know if there's an actual trend here in these new claims for unemployment and what that means. And there are a couple other numbers that are befuddling me that I have to ask you about. But first, let's start with that.
There is a trend indeed in the jobless claims figure this morning. This is one of those series that we get every week. It basically tallies the number of people who are filing a new claim for unemployment benefits. So it gives us one way of telling in sort of real time how the labor market is doing. Now, this series, okay, so last week there were about 12,000 fewer claims than the week before. The level itself was 502,000. Now, 500,000 is still a lot,
sure,
but that is the lowest level since January and sharply lower than the recent high of about 675,000 in March. So even though the series doesn't usually provide a lot of information week to week, there's a clear trend here of improvement in the labor market that goes a little bit counter to the rising unemployment rate.
Now, Walmart, biggest retailer in the world, says its earnings rose 3.2%, but it's guarded for the holidays. Are retailers terrified, or are they looking good? Earnings are all over the map.
It's a little bit all over the map. It seems like there's some strength among the real price-sensitive retailers. By that, I mean the ones that people really go to when they're looking for a bargain. So Walmart doing well, sort of beat its earnings. A lot of people were worried that that it would start to sag compared to a year ago, because it actually did relatively well as people were sort of shying away from higher priced items last year. So those kind of stores, Walmart, Kohl's had good earnings this morning. In fact, some of the luxury stores like Nordstrom's have seen improvement in their
stuff. That was
lately.
A real What's surprise.
The middle is almost the middle that's hurt right now, because they don't really have a clear image. You know, people are either looking for a bargain, or if they're going to splurge, they're going to, you know, go buy that thing at Nordstrom's. But a lot are getting caught in the middle. It does look like it's going to be a merrier Christmas than last year.
And some economists are saying that this is showing signs that we're locking into lower spending levels post-recession. But I don't want to talk about that. Obama is leaving for Asia. And my question is, with the dollar just doing so awfully and the stock market doing so well, is the president selling dollars over there in China?
Well, the dollar is at about a 15-month low against a basket of other currencies. There, of course, is always angst when this happens. People like a strong dollar. It feels good. It feels patriotic. The problem is, if you talk to a lot of economists right now and people in the Obama administration, they kind of recognize that the weak dollar is helping our exporters right now. It's helping foreign demand for our products, for our services, at a time when we really need that. So unless the dollar crashes, this sort of slow move downward is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, some economists, such as Jan Hatzius, chief economist at Goldman Sachs, have said that they think that it should actually fall further.
And if you're going to trade the issue of declining value of dollar holders like China and Saudi Arabia with the potential for more jobs if demand increases in the United States, you're going to go with the demand and let the dollar fall. Kelly Evans, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Kelly Evans, Wall Street Journal reporter. And speaking of jobs, the president is now speaking live at the White House and announcing that he's going to hold a jobs summit at the White House in December. Let's recall the unemployment rate is 10.2% for last month. But last week, new claims for unemployment were down 12,000, 502,000. That's the lowest level since January.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm John Huckaberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, combing the emotional wreckage of the battlefield, Woody Harrelson and Ben Foster talk about their new film, The Messenger. And right now, let's check on the leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. The president has just finished speaking, announcing that he's holding a job summit at the White House in December.
Even though we've slowed the loss of jobs, and today's report on the continued decline in unemployment claims is a hopeful sign, the economic growth that we've seen has not yet led to the job growth that we desperately need.
The president was referring to new claims for unemployment falling by 12,000 to 502,000 last week, lowest since January.
President Obama is setting off on his first trip to Asia since taking office. He'll head to Japan and then go to China for 3 days. He'll wrap up the trip in South Korea. Going to Afghanistan, the president's expected to announce his revamped war strategy as he returns from the Far East. Officials say the president has rejected the options presented to him by his national security team. And finally, it's raining all along much of the Atlantic seaboard. The wet weather is triggering coastal flood warnings from North Carolina to Long Island. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
So call it good timing or bad timing, but with the nation focused on the real issues of stress in the military and the sacrifices of military families and soldiers in harm's way, a movie is opening this weekend in limited release. You might say it is shot on location on the front lines of the military's emotional battlefield. It's called The Messenger, and there's not a single combat scene in the movie. It stars Woody Harrelson and Ben Foster and was directed by Oren Movermann. It's a profile of the casualty notification teams who deliver the worst possible news to military families.
We call each casualty by name. We honor them. You with me?
Yes, sir.
One more thing. Avoid physical contact with the next of kin. You are representing the Secretary of the Army, not Will Montgomery, so in case you feel like offering a hug or something, don't. It'll only get you in trouble.
I'm not going to be offering any hugs, sir.
This amazing movie is about a lot of things, about the dangers of emotional involvement, about the moment that exists before a casualty notifier tells someone that their loved one is gone. It stars Woody Harrelson and Ben Foster. They're here with us in the studio. Woody Harrelson, let's start with you. What is it like to try to recreate that moment of notification? I mean, you're the expert in this film.
Yeah,
it's hard to imagine what it would really be like, because you're laying the most horrible news on somebody. But, you know, for us, it was interesting how it was shot, because Oren set it up to be one camera. We didn't meet the people we were notifying ahead of time. There was no rehearsal. And so there were.
Did it just add to the reality of it? Did you know what reaction they were going to have just from the script? Did you know?
No, right. There was no way to tell. You know, sometimes, like, he got, you know, pushed and by Steve Buscemi, and you know, there's certain things that happened that we had no idea. So.
Well, here's the first scene when your character Ben goes on a notification for the first time, and of course your character Woody Harrelson is an old hand at this, and this is the first scene in the movie where you enter a home and give the bad news. Listen.
Bad news, Mr. Burrell. Secretary of the Army has asked me to express his deepest regret that your son, Private First Class Leroy Burrell.
No! You gotta go.
I'm very sorry, Mrs. Burrell.
No! Listen! No! That's my baby. We can't do this, right? Now look,
your
Monica!
Son was killed yesterday by a roadside bomb. Casualty assistant.
No! Don't you say that about my baby!
Now, that smack is delivered to you, Woody Harrelson. And the way this thing is shot is we see your faces throughout the movie, but up to this point, then the camera turns away. It's almost as though I'm being hit watching this. It's so vivid. Was that deliberate on the part of the director?
Yeah, I think so. And that slap was unexpected. You know? there was a lot of unexpected things that happened.
Ben, I saw you in profile in that scene. It looked like you were breaking down.
What we do is we try to just lose the intellect for a moment and just connect, feel with each other. And Oren Moverman, our writer-director, created an environment that supported that getting lost together.
So it's as much about this environment that was created as it was about visiting Walter Reed, as both of you did, Walter Reed Army Medical Center, to find out from the veteran's perspective what this is like, right?
It's a life-changing experience to see the scars of the young men and women who've come back missing pieces. You see the scars. We're touching wounds. We're hearing stories. It adds a quality, a weight to the chilly statistics that we hear on the news every day. You're seeing children blown up.
You know, one of the scenes, Woody, that really struck me in that was early on when you're in the bar and you're saying, I wish they would show the footage on television every single funeral of every single soldier. And I had to feel as though maybe you came away from the film feeling the same way, or maybe are these things too wrenching and too draining to go through this each time?
Well, I think it's important for people to have a concept of the consequences of war as opposed to just hearing statistics, you know? And that's kind of what the movie tends to do, is to put a human face on the costs of war.
It also takes us into a world that I think is a mystery up until now.
Yeah.
This casualty notification service is something that's very worked out, and as we find out in the movie, there are rules to notifying people of deaths or injuries.
You do not speak with anybody other than the next of kin. No friend, no neighbor, no co-worker or mistress. Hours of operation are 0600 to 2200 hours. We don't want to wake anybody up in the middle of the night. Though if you ask me, hitting them with the news at the crack of dawn is not exactly a great way to start their day, breakfast-wise.
Now that is the macho of delivering the worst possible news. You say that with such conviction. So what did you learn about the perils of emotional involvement? And all of the rules that you talk about in the film are all about keeping a distance from the people that you're notifying. What did you learn about the dangers of emotional involvement? It seems to me that's an issue for actors all the time.
Oh, it's an issue for human beings. We're so afraid of getting hurt, and we're so terrified in a culture that doesn't want to address the inevitability of loss, losing loved ones, which happens to all of us. The film, hopefully, beneath the hat of the military, is really about how do we get through the difficult times in our lives and remember how to love again, how to create relationships, how to connect. It's not something that has easy answers other than it's okay to feel, and it's okay to ask for help, and it's okay to love again.
And it is a war movie, but it is, you know, this ground, as emotional as it sounds, is totally entertaining. I mean, I was completely riveted in this movie.
You can't look away. You know, I have to ask, do you feel like this is an anti-war movie? Do you feel, I mean, because you do come away from this movie feeling like the toll of every soldier's death is just too heavy a burden. I mean, I came away from this movie just feeling like, oh, every single casualty is just almost too much to bear. But I'm not sure that the movie was necessarily anti-war. What did you think?
I think that Oren and Alessandro, who wrote the script, were very careful to keep it non-political. But apropos of what you just said a minute ago, I do want people to know that this movie is not just entirely depressing.
Yeah. Exactly. No, it is. It's very entertaining.
There's a lot of humor and uplift, and it's worth seeing.
So you don't say, oh, I'm glad that's over. Now I get to go do 2012, a disaster.
Zombieland, right?
You don't feel that way. Is this the project you prefer?
This is my favorite movie I've ever been a part of. It means so much to me, and I care a lot about it. And just the bond, the time I spent with Ben, and as well as with Oren and Lawrence Ingley, the producer, we're all incredibly tight now, and we forge friendships that'll last forever. But it's all about this movie.
Well, it's a final thought there, Ben Foster?
I just love this fellow, and his performance is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen.
Well, at the risk of all of us hugging here, thanks you guys for coming in. Ben Foster co-stars in the new movie The Messenger with Woody Harrelson. Both actors joined us here in the studio. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
The Messenger with Woody Harrelson and Ben Foster comes out in selected cities this Friday. It goes wide release next week. And the conversation continues on our website. And Oren Moberman, the director, joins it. The video and more on our website, thetakeaway.org.
While you're there, you can catch up on anything you missed by taking our podcast to go. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org. Today, we're talking about President Obama's trip to Asia. From its economic growth to its geopolitical status, it's a huge holder of American debt. China is a country on the rise. Do you think China is posed to rule the world? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
It's not a matter of if we jumpstart Japan, we can jumpstart ourselves, then we can block China's rise or something like that. It simply doesn't set up that way at all in the real world.
That's Kenneth Lieberfall over the Brookings Institution.
I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.